Good morning, everybody. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee to order. Today is April 6th, 2022. And pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. Mr. Brinks, can you take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Present.
Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson present.
Carlson is present. Representative Nash.
Nash present.
Nash is present. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Bonner is present. Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Drazkowski is present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Greenman is present. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne present.
Cleborne is present. Representative Kosnick. Representative Mason. Representative New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley is present. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski present.
Pawlowski is present. Representative Quam.
Present.
Quam is present. Representative Kosnick. Kosnick is excused. Representative Mason. Mason is excused. Chair, with that, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum. The next item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes from April 1st, 2022. Representative Carlson, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move approval of the April 1st minutes.
Motion been made to approve the minutes from April 1st. All in favor, if you want to briefly unmute, all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The motions are approved. Members, we are going to be doing the walkthrough this morning of our omnibus bill. Amendments to the DE2 amendment are due today by 3 p.m. Hopefully we can get all those in and so we don't have any issues. I will move the House File 4293 to have it before us, and I'll move the DE2 amendment to have it before us. And with that, I'll have Mr. Gehring and Ms. Roberts do the walk through the bill, explain provisions. Mr. Gehring, are you going first?
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Roberts will go first with the spreadsheet.
Ms. Roberts, if you want to go through the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair, this is Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff, and I'm sharing my screen. I just want to make sure that people can see it.
Yep, we can see it.
Okay. So for this presentation, I'm going to be walking through the spreadsheet, and I will only be going through the change items and only the columns that represent the DE2 amendment. We found it's easier for members to see if we only show limited columns, but as always, I can provide additional information to members, such as the governor's recommendations or comparison to the base outside of this presentation. To begin with, I'm going to start with the first group of change items, which is for the legislature. On line 6, you can see there's a House operating adjustment of $1.2 million for fiscal year 23. On line 7, there is a $200,000 operating adjustment for the House Sergeant-at-Arms. On line 8, for the LCC, an operating adjustment of $869,000. This is for all of the LCC joint offices, including the legislative auditor, revisor, library, and all the various commissions. On line 9, $185,000 for a diversity and inclusion officer for the entire legislature. On line 10 of the spreadsheet, there is funding for translation services for the legislature. This is from House File 2545, Representative Lee's bill. And then on line 11, $30,000 increase for the Pension Commission actuarial services. On line 12, you'll see the funding for House File 4036, Representative Claiborne's bill for the Legislative Task Force on Aging. That's $138,000. And then finally, on line 13, for the revisor of statutes, $14 million in a one-time request for an information technology project to replace the bill drafting system. So the total, and I'm sorry, I realize that I'm showing the Excel view, which is probably not, let me see if I can at least get that page one off of there. The total for the legislature is $16.9 million. Moving on, for the Attorney General, there's an operating adjustment of $2.3 million. For the Secretary of State, there's two change items in the direct appropriations. The first is $210,000 for a chief information officer. And then on line 27, $100,000 for civic engagement and youth outreach. In addition to these two appropriations, at the end of the appropriations article, you'll find the state match for the most recent round of federal election security funding, or the HABA funds, and that's $230,000. Moving down to the Campaign Finance Board, there's a one-time appropriation of $5,000 to cover the costs for the board for implementation of House File 3190. That's Representative Long's bill. Moving on to Minute Services on line 35, or on 36, there is funding for the state match for the federal cybersecurity grant program. On line 37, the enterprise cloud transformation, a total of $12.4 million in fiscal year 22-23. On line 38, under executive branch technology modernization, $10.2 million in the current biennium. On line 39, for accessibility assessment, $256,000. And then for the Children's Cabinet IT innovation, $750,000. And finally, the last change item for Minute is the funding for advanced cybersecurity tools of $10.2 million. So the total general fund change for Minute would be $35.6 million. In addition, there's $150,000 from the Special Revenue Fund for supporting accessible technology in state government. And then finally, on line 44, you see the cybersecurity grant program. These are the federal dollars that would be matched by the state dollars above. Moving on to the Department of Administration on line 47, $250,000 for enterprise language access services. This is a transfer out of the general fund. $1.9 million for the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, known as PTAC, and also for a disparity study. On line 49, there's another general fund transfer of $630,000. This would be a transfer to the Fleet Fund. That's an internal service fund, and it's to address revenue loss in that fund. Next, on line 50, $301,000 for improving human resources and financial services. On line 51, there's $556,000 for the Office of Enterprise Translations. And then on line 52, $400,000 for improving grants administration oversight. On line 53, you'll see the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution, $150,000. On line 54, $773,000 in one-time funding for the Ampers Community Radio Service. Below that, on line 55, $200,000 for the Minnesota Field Archaeology and Private Cemeteries Act update contained in this amendment. And then moving down, you'll see two additional appropriations related to COVID worker compensation costs. The first, there's $1 million in one-time funds for state agency workers' comp claims that were incurred prior to March 4th of 2021. And then beneath that on line 57, $2.5 million for COVID workers' compensation costs related to Chapter 32. You may remember that this was a bill that was passed, I believe, in the first or second week of this session. And finally, for under admin, there are There's $2 million for public television block grants. That's for House Files 4248. That's Representative Carlson's bill. And so the total general fund change for admin is $10.7 million. Moving on to Minnesota management and budget, on line 65, there's $7.3 million to stabilize and sustain the state's ERP systems. Then underneath that, there's $1 million for cross-agency coordination related to the Children's Cabinet. On line 68, $300,000 for evaluating the impact of state investments. And then finally, under a minute, there is $93,000, or under M&B, excuse me, $93,000 for implementing the recommendations of the Task Force on Employees with Disabilities. This was House File 2017, Representative Ryer's bill. So the total for M&B is $8.7 million change in the general fund. For the Historical Society, there are three change items. The first is $500,000 for an operating adjustment. Second, one-time funding of $750,000 for operational support for the reopening of historic sites across the state. And then finally, $32,000 for the State Emblem Commission. This was House File 284, Representative Freiberg's bill. So a total change for the Historical Society of $1.3 million in fiscal year 23. Moving down for the Humanities Center, there is an operating adjustment of $22,000. That's on line 85. And then on line 89, for the Board of Accountancy, $120,000 for licensing and enforcement program support. And then the last two items, under expenditures, for the Barber's Examiners Board, there's $17,000 in one-time costs. These are related to the licensing modifications that were in House File 3986, Representative Nelson's bill. And then finally, for the Cosmetologist Examiners Board, $20,000 for implementation of the OLA recommendations. This was House File 4390, Representative Mason's bill. So moving down on line 118, you can see the total general fund change is $76.2 million, and then additional $400,000 from the Special Revenue Fund. So the net expenditure change for all funds is $76.6 million. At the bottom of the spreadsheet, you'll see there's some really very small revenue changes related to some of the provisions in the bill, and those would total $3,000. And so the net general fund change, going down to the very last line of the spreadsheet, this is the net of both expenditures and revenue changes, is the 76.638. That's for all funds. For general fund, it's 76.238. And I know I went through that very fast, but if there are any questions, let me know. Otherwise, I'll stop sharing my screen.
Representative Elkins, you've got your hand up.
Just a real quick question. There is an appropriation somewhere here for the Office of Small Agencies to do a study, and I see it on all of the bill summaries, but I don't see where it's buried on Ms. Roberts' spreadsheet.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, I believe that is you're right, sort of buried in the spreadsheet on line 50 under improving human resources and financial services.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep.
With that, no more questions. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Matt Gehring from House Research Department. I'm going to share the screen here. And what I'll do is walk through the DE2 document. Within the committee materials, there's a section by section summary as well as this tracking kind of policy chart. That's the one that's shared on the screen here. I'm going to go through fairly quickly all the policy items just to highlight mostly where they come from and just give a general overview of what they are, starting with section or with Article 2, which starts on page 9 of the DE2 amendment. So section 1 of Article 2 on page 9 is the first section that comes from the LCC's technical administrative bill that the committee saw earlier. This is the section that allows the director of the LCC to enter contracts. Section 2 comes from House File 3087, which is the language that allows the Executive Council to accept other types of collateral for deposit with MMB. Section 3 is the first of two sections from Representative Richardson's bill that this one aligns the date of the current state observance of Juneteenth so that it falls on June 19th of each year. And then later on in this article is the actual designation of Juneteenth as an official state holiday. Sections 4 through 10 all come from Representative Bonner's House File 4568. This is the language that runs from pages 11 through 14 of the DE2. This is the language that authorizes the governor to use his Chapter 12 emergency powers to respond to cyber attacks and other threats against the state's IT systems. Moving ahead to page 15. Section 11, which is part of the governor's supplemental policy request related to data practices and the process for appealing a decision about an individual's data classification. Section 12 also comes from that same bill, the governor's bill, related to the fees that are charged for requests for an advisory opinion on open meetings law issues. Sections 13 through 15, this is pages 17 and 18 of the DE2, come from the LCC bill. This is language that updates and makes current the statutes that govern the Legislative Salary Council. So some of the language there is now obsolete because the Salary Council has met for several cycles now and the dates can be removed. Sections 16 and 17 go together. This is also from the governor's supplemental policy bill. This is the language that changes the way that billing is made for statewide systems from the statewide systems account. The statewide systems are the payroll accounting systems, HR and procurement systems, and other information access systems. Next is a series of sections that come from the Department of Administration's bill. Sections 18 through 23 all have admin language in them. These are the sections that relate to the work of the State Designer Board and when the State Designer Selection Board is required to be used. Built in there is also the codification of the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution. Sections 24 and 25 come from the governor's policy request. This is the establishment of the Office of Enterprise Translation within the Department of Administration, and there's both the creation of that office as well as the account established to fund those types of services within state government. Section 26 on page 24 of the DE2 authorizes agencies to retain a default percentage of appropriations for grants for administrative costs associated with administering the grants. Sections 27 and 28 also come from the Department of Administration's bill related to both the Designer Selection Board process and then also the emergency acquisition of certain types of purchases. Section 29 is the language that allows MNIT to make grants to local governments for cybersecurity risks and threats. And then there's a series of sections that starts on page 27 of the DE2, running all the way through page 44. There are sections 30 through 54, all come from Representative Ryer's House File 2017. This is the language that came out of the Task Force on State Employees and with disabilities. So there's a whole series of sections related to that work here. Within those sections, I just want to highlight two sections, 44 and 45 on page 34 of the DE2, are not related to the state employees with disabilities. Those are the military differential pay sections that the committee heard about last week. And then, Mr. Chair, moving ahead to page 45 of the DE2, you'll see section 55. This is the first of the few sections that relate to the deposit of certain funds into trust accounts that go to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And then, let's see, I lost my place here. Section 56, also on page 45, is the language that comes from Representative Albright's bill. There's also language in there from Representative Freiberg that expands the ability of local governments to choose investments for their funds. That's sections 56, 57, and 58. On section 59 on page 47 of the DE2 is language that expands the qualification criteria that the governor must consider when making appointments to the Minnesota State Board of Trustees. The Trustee Candidate Advisory Council is being repealed as part of the LCC's administrative bill. That repealer comes a little bit later in this article. Sections 60 and 61, also on page 47, come from the part of the administration's bill. And there's actually, we sort of bounce back and forth through a series of sections that go back and forth between the Department of Administration's bill and the LCC's administrative bill. Section 62 comes from the LCC's bill. It clarifies the appointment terms and process for citizen members of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. Section 63 is a fairly long section that makes some updates to the laws that govern the treatment of human burial sites and cemeteries around the state. Then section 64, 65, and 66 go back to the housing policy I mentioned earlier about the way that certain funds are deposited with the state and the designation of those funds to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. On page 60, section 67 comes from Representative Hansen's bill. This is the language that relates to the local government's permission for creation of the use of native landscapes on properties within local governments. Section 68 is the section I mentioned earlier that designates Juneteenth, June 19th of each year as an official state holiday rather than just the existing state observance. That comes from Representative Richardson's bill. Section 69 relates back to the military salary differential issue that the committee heard about last week. Section 70 is the IRRRB separation retention incentive program. That's Representative Eklund's bill that the committee heard last week. Section 71 is the policy section that goes along with Representative Elkins's question about the funding for the small agency study. This is the actual direction in Section 71 of Article 2 to conduct that study and the details for what will be studied. On page 63 of the DE2, Section 72 is the first section that relates to Representative Freiberg's State Emblems Redesign Commission. This is the language that would establish a commission to review both the state seal and the official state flag and recommend new designs for both that would be effective if the legislature adopts them May 11th of 2023. Section 74 on page 64 of the DE2 is Representative Cleborne's Legislative Task Force on Aging. This is the task force that would study the possibility of creating a new State Department on Aging. Section 75 relates back to Representative Ryer's House File 2017. This is the recommendations of the Task Force on State Employees with Disabilities. Section 76 is a reviser instruction directing the reviser of statutes supported by House Research and Senate Counsel to review statutes for compliance with the Equal Rights Amendment. And Section 77, the last section of this article, contains a number of repealers that sort of go along with other policy items that are I previously talked about in the bill. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of Article 2. That's the general state government policy article. And then next, I'm going to move to Article 3. Article 3 starts on page 69 of the DE2, if you're following along. A whole bunch of sections in this article come from the Secretary of State's Elections Administrative Technical Bill. This committee has seen those sections in a variety of forms and places over the last several years. So I'm not going to talk through those. I'm just going to highlight the sort of things that are new to the committee this year or maybe different. So the first section I'm going to highlight in Article 3 is Section 2. This is Representative Long's bill that establishes the definition of expressly advocating in the campaign finance law. And as a reminder, this term is used to determine whether a campaign expenditure has to be reported to the campaign finance board. or I should say whether an expenditure is a campaign expenditure that has to be reported to the board. On page 70, section 3 of Article 3 is Representative Cleghorn's bill that relates to special access for lobbyists to certain facilities and events that are hosted by candidates for office. And then I'm going to move ahead to page 82 of Article 3. Again, everything in between there is the Secretary of State's Elections Administrative Bill. Section 21 on page 82 is the first of a series of sections from Representative Cleghorn's bill that extends the period of time during which absentee ballots can be opened and counted, as well as the ability for individuals to vote using a live ballot machine from 7 days prior to an election to 14 days. So there's a number of sections that will come that conform to that new standard of a 14-day period rather than a 7-day period for that work to happen. On page 83, section 22 is Representative Greenman's language that the committee heard last week related to the use of absentee ballot boxes. So there's new standards for placement of those ballot boxes and how they're distributed around the jurisdiction, among other things. That's section 22. Section 23 goes along with that bill that requires some documentation of who is accessing the ballot boxes, how many ballots are collected, and the like. Section 25 of Article 3 goes back to Representative Cleghorn's bill about the timing of the counting of absentee ballots. Section 26 is the same, as well as Section 27, all relate to Representative Cleghorn's bill. Moving ahead to Section 33 of Article 3, that's another piece of Representative Greenman's bill requiring certain statistics about absentee ballots to be reported to the Secretary of State, who then reports them to the legislature about the method of voting, whether it's the use of the drop box, mail, in person, or direct balloting. Section 36, this is on page 93 of the DE2, is I think the last one, that's one of Representative Cleghorn's sections, again, that goes to the timing of the absentee balloting process and the extension of the period from 7 days to 14 days during which ballots may be open and counted. This is a conforming change to go along with those sections. On page 96, sections 42 and 43 also relate to Representative Cleghorn's bill. And then I'm going to move ahead to page 103. Sections 55, 56, and 57 are all from Representative Long's bill. This is the section that has relates to the appropriation of the Campaign Finance Board that Ms. Roberts talked about. This is requiring additional disclosure of donors on independent expenditures. The top three donors would need to be identified on independent expenditures. And then there's also the requirement that the Campaign Finance Board establish standards for how a disclaimer will be printed on items where it's small items where it's difficult to actually print a full disclaimer. On page 104 of the DE2, section 58 is Representative Nash's bill. This is the language that requires certain notices on mailings that are sent by private organizations that include an absentee ballot application or a sample ballot. And then section 59 and page 105 is Representative Greenman's bill that relates to intimidation or interference with the duties of an election official. This is the bill that the committee heard several weeks ago that includes both criminal and civil enforcement remedies and a number of activities that are prohibited that relate to interference and intimidation of election officials. Section 61 goes along with that makes clear that the administrative process does not apply to the remedies that are established for that intimidation and interference work. It's instead both a civil and criminal penalty process, which would go through the traditional court system. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of Article 3. Again, the sections I didn't highlight in that walkthrough all relate back to the Secretary of State's administrative bill that the committee has heard before. And then lastly, Article 4 is the last article of the DE2. This is the barbering and cosmetology article. Sections 1 through 16 of that article, which runs from page 109 to page 120, are all the technical and administrative updates of the Board of Barber Examiners. The focus, there's a variety of sort of missile changes there. The focus is primarily on the barber examination process, as well as requirements that relate to mobile barbershops. And then starting with section 17 on page 121 through the end of the article is the sections that relate to the practice of cosmetology. There's, again, a variety of sections there. There's a focus on establishing a three-year license for hair technicians and other implementation of the recommendations of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And then the last section in that article is a repealer that relates back to the Board of Barber Examiners. And Mr. Chair, that is the entirety of the DE2 and the policy contained in Articles 2 through 4.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Next, we'll start with our testifiers and on my list here. And members, I just put it on the record, Representative Kosnick and Representative Mason are now were able to get in and are here with us, so be counted as present. So now we'll start with our testifiers. The first person I have on my list is Barb Dulick, controller for the House. And if you want to identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barb Dulick, and I am the controller for the House of Representatives. There are two requests for supplemental funding for the House before you today. The first request of $1.2 million is for an operational adjustment related to staff compensation. As you are aware, the House commissioned an NCSL compensation study in 2019. That study stated that the House of Representatives needed a process to keep salary ranges current and that most employers move salary ranges based on a cost of living figure. It further stated that every 2 years, the House should review salary ranges for all positions to keep the compensation schedules current. And absent movement of these ranges, an employer cannot compete to attract qualified candidates and often lose employers to better pay employees to better paying positions. And while the House did implement the NCSL report recommendations with significant salary adjustments in fiscal year 20 and 21, and last year the House did adopt a 2.5% COLA increase for staff for fiscal year 22 and 23, the approved increases are not keeping pace with recent cost of living increases. And like other employers, we are experiencing significant staffing issues. Since July 1, 2021, we have lost 39 staff positions. In an even fiscal year, which we are in, we typically lose about half of what we've been currently experiencing. For example, in fiscal years 14, 16, and 20, staff turnover ranged from 17 to 22 positions at this time, compared to the current 39. The one exception was fiscal year 18, which was just prior to the NCSL study being commissioned. We had a turnover of 30 positions at this point of that fiscal year. It has also become very difficult attracting candidates to open positions. In the past, we have received 50 to 60 and sometimes even more applications for a position, where today we receive 10 or less, and sometimes as few as two or three. Hiring of temporary staff has also been difficult. This is the first time in 25 years that the chief clerk's office was unable to hire their full complement of temporary staff at the beginning of to start session. And then finally, due to a number of unknowns in the budget, the biennial budget request last year, we did not include any funding for any merit increases. Absent a merit increase, anyone hired at the entry level of pay for their position after April 1st of 2020, so 2 years ago, is making the same as somebody hired today. This will continue to be the case until merit increases are approved, as merit increases allow you to move through the range as your experience grows. Merit increases also allow the House to maintain alignment with the executive branch step increases. As stated, the supplemental budget requests an annual increase of $1.2 million. This is equivalent to 5.2% salary base adjustment. This would allow the House to address the differences between the currently approved 2.5% COLA for the fiscal years 22 and 23 and recent inflationary increases, and also consider a merit. If funds are appropriated, the Rules Committee would review and approve any actual staffing adjustments. The second proposal is for increased security resources for the Sergeant at Arms office. This $200,000 proposal increases the House permanent staffing complement by 2 FTE and would add one additional temporary staff position to the Sergeant at Arms session complement. With that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyerson is here to answer a question on the staffing request, and I can stand for questions on the compensation request.
Thank you, Ms. Julek. Any questions? If not, we'll try and get through the testifiers. And Mr. Meyerson, if you want to identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Olson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Meyerson. I have the honor to serve as the Chief Sergeant of Arms for the House. And as we've professionalized the Sergeant of Arms Department over the years, we've adjusted what staff we hire and how we deploy the staff. And the staffing increases that we're asking for are going to allow us to continue to appropriately place staff in positions to deter, detect, and to respond to internal security concerns that come about. That said, I would prefer not to talk specifically about our security vulnerabilities and measures that we do take would go against good security procedures in itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyerson. And as a former locksmith, I understand about security. Any questions about his request for additional staff? Seeing no hands jump up. Well, the next person on my list is Ryan Inman. If you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Nelson, members, good morning. My name is Ryan Inman. I am the reviser of statutes here at the Minnesota Legislature. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with this morning about our important IS initiative. For those of you that were sitting on this committee in 2019, you may remember that back then I said this project was coming down the tracks. We've reached a point now, 3 years later, where we're arriving in the station, and that's why we're here today. Our ask is $14 million for a replacement of the existing legislative drafting system, which we call Extend. It's used across all three entities, so the Revisor's Office, both the House and the Senate as well. We've been live with this current system since about 2004, 2005, so it's getting a little bit old. But the primary reason we're looking at replacing it is really threefold. The first is that it relies on a lot of technology and software that vendors are either discontinuing or moving away from. Chief among these is the editor, which, while still supported, we've received informal indications that that may not be the case moving forward. So we certainly need to be prepared to manage that. Another reason is that the code base that we use for this existing system is really antiquated and unnecessarily complex. As part of the development process for this particular system, we used in-house staff along with some vendor products and a number of independent contractors. And so each of those individual contractors and entities had slightly different ways of doing things. And so unbundling all of that differing code has proven difficult over time. It also makes it difficult for us to maintain and change things without negatively impacting performance. And then third, the world has just changed a bit. The cloud wasn't really a thing back in the early 2000s when we were originally considering the system. Web-based apps were very, very limited, and there wasn't much by way of integrated and managed workflow, certainly not in the legislative arena. As part of this process, our core goal really has been to maintain and enhance existing functionality, but then also add additional tools that will help all of you do your job. So as part of the appropriation, you're getting a whole bunch of different things. That includes a continuation of the development phase, documentation phase that we've been engaged in for the last 4 or 5 years. It also includes all of the legislative drafting tools that you've come to know and appreciate, all those documents, including side-by-sides, bills, amendments, those sorts of things. It will also continue to support in an enhanced manner our codification and publication tools on the editing side, the administrative rule drafting work that we do for the executive branch, and it also will include all the system testing and stabilization along with deployment, training, and support along the way. The two real enhancements to the system are a member tracking portal. So basically that will allow members to request bills and work with staff and other members through a content management system. So you'll be able to request your bills. You'll be able to securely and confidentially work with staff on legislation. You'll be able to use it to solicit co-authors and work with them in a single platform. It'll also allow you to maintain things like notes, amendments, other supporting documents as you move your bills through the legislative process. It'll also allow you to do things like if you ask for a bill and you're wondering why it hasn't been jacketed yet, you'll be able to see very quickly in one place where all of that is. So a benefit, I think, to both you and to our office as well. That's all made possible by the really big enhancement to the system, which is a legislative workflow content management system. What we found throughout the pandemic is that there are certain elements of our work that we actually are more effective and efficient at in an electronic environment. Data entry and making changes to bills is actually easier for our staff working digitally than it was when we were working on paper. The problem is that all of those efficiencies have been swallowed up by administrative processes we've needed to set up and maintain in order to track all of that paper. We put together thousands and thousands of documents, bills, amendments, and otherwise over the course of session. And without a system to help manage that, we spend a lot of time, a lot of staff time administering that. And so this system will really help with that a lot. The other big advantage to a content management system is that it gives us the flexibility to add tools for you to use in the future. Many other states that are using some of these systems are getting things like committee management, floor management, remote voting. These are all tools that we can add on either initially or down the road to make sort of a more fulsome, coherent legislative management experience, both for members and staff in both bodies. Obviously, we'll have requisite security requirements. It'll help us with some of the ADA compliance and those sort of things, too. Again, the ask is $14 million. That number is based largely on an equivalent system in a Western state that's being developed now. They're in year three or four of a six-year project. The amount also includes any money needed to cover contingencies or change items as part of our process. I do anticipate it would be a four to six-year project. Hopefully, we can phase the implementation, but it'll probably take us that long to get it fully deployed and out into the wild. So at that point, the existing system will be in the mid, you know, hitting its early to mid-20s and getting really, really old. So with that, I appreciate sort of the 30,000 quick and dirty view of this system. Happy to answer any questions you may have, but otherwise, I appreciate the committee's consideration and your continued support of the revisor's office.
And Mr. Inman, no surprise, we have one or two people that are IT people, and I see the first hand that jumped up is Representative Bonner.
Yes, thank you so much, and I'll try to be quick and not bore the rest of my committee members. But I am curious, first of all, with the content management system, do we know if we have any ideas if there's any potential out-of-the-box solutions for content management that we're considering, or are we thinking that we're going to have to do more of a custom build?
Chair Nelson, Representative Bonner, the short answer is yes, there are off-the-shelf products available that didn't exist back in the early 2000s. As we've been going through this process, the first item we looked at was whether or not we could do this type of work entirely in-house. And quite frankly, I don't think that we have the staff size or experience to put together a wholesale legislative content management system. The good news is that there are multiple vendors that have a lot of experience nationally here and internationally putting these systems together for state legislatures, for international legislatures or legislative bodies that we can rely on. And so we'll very much steal liberally from those folks as we can, learn those lessons, and then build things that are important to us in Minnesota because we do things differently here.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. If one last request before we move on, I know that Representative Elkins and I in particular are very keen in our abundant spare time, I say that with a slight laugh, do like to dig into some of these things. So if you have additional information on other states that are using these systems that we might be able to look at or get a better idea and understanding about, I certainly would appreciate that. And I suspect Representatives Nash or Elkins may as well. So that would be really helpful. And I do want to emphasize for the record that I really do hope that a large part of that conversation will be around people-centered development and doing incremental development, that very phased approach which you mentioned. Thanks so much for your time.
Representative Mason, quickly, if you have a question, and I have one more question, we need to move on. We've got a whole list of testifiers here to get through. So, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is from Mr. Inman. Basically, what I'm hearing you say is that you're making some, sounds like substantial improvements to the system, which sounds good, and we certainly want you to be current. Because my question has to be, because I keep hearing that your department is kind of under a lot of stress lately. So my question is it relate? How is your staff adapting to the COVID situation where we're working at home, et cetera? And then the other thing that I'm aware of is that we're approaching 5,000 bills this year, which is supposedly a record. So how is that? Are you able to cope with what you have at this point, given that we're dealing with so many other things?
Mr. Inman, and yes, we set a record last year for the number of bills, or last biennium for the number of bills introduced, and we're setting a record again this biennium for the number of bills introduced, and I don't think that's a good record to be going after. So, Mr. Inman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Mason, we are seeing an increase in the amount of bills that we're drafting. It's been an upward trend for a number of years. The good news is that the system that we currently have has proven durable and reliable. Please, everyone, knock on all of the wood around you. It's been a really good system for us. We have had to make changes. When the system was originally developed, it didn't envision 1,000-page bills. That's just a reality. So we've had to expand its capacity. As far as the transition to remote work, I actually think we've done a relatively good job. The fact that we were able to have a record number of bills the previous biennium and are having a well above average biennium this past 2 years is evidence of the fact that all of us, including the folks in House Research and Senate Council, have done a pretty good job adapting. It was a big change. I think all of us that were around in the early stages of 2020 remember that it was a difficult sort of rocky transition, but I think we've figured out a way to make it work. Hopefully a system like this will make it easier in the future should, God forbid, we ever end up in a similar situation.
Thank you.
And Mr. and Representative Elkins, you'll be the last questioner of this one, and we'll move on. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, just a real quick comment. At a data privacy conference that Representative Nash and I attended last November, I met the person at the National Conference of State Legislators who is kind of keeps tabs on what states are doing in this area, and I'm drawing a blank on her name, but I can connect you because we are actually very well regarded by NCSL staff in terms of our capabilities, especially our legislative websites.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. The next person I have on my list of testifiers, I have two that needed to answer questions. Michelle Weber's here to answer questions. And Susan Lincheski is here to answer a question from the Pension Commission. So the next person I have on my list is Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office. Ms. Freeman, if you want to identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony. You're muted still.
All right, just getting my camera on. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. It's great to see you all again. I am here today to speak in support of several measures in the bill. The office, whether it's me or one of my colleagues or the secretary himself, has provided testimony previously on all of the bills included here, so I'll keep my testimony rather brief. First of all, on the funding portion, we appreciate the funding of our supplemental budget requests. These two positions are really critical to our office and will help us expand our outreach efforts, as well as the CIO will really allow for further capacity in our IT programs and oversight of the large IT projects that our office manages. Thank you also for the HAVA fund appropriation and state match. Those funds will be used as well. On the policy side of things, We know that allowing local jurisdictions to expand direct balloting and their ballot board opening to 14 days is a provision that both voters as well as administrators really support widely. Voting ahead of Election Day in person has become increasingly popular amongst voters, and this expands to the 14 days of direct balloting. It eases the administrative burden with the envelope process of in-person absentee voting as well. It also responds to voters' wishes, which is a win-win for both groups. So the permissive language allowing ballot boards to begin their work dealing with those absentee envelopes, that opening and process of absentee ballots is flexibility that is widely supported by local administrators. The secretary, I think when he spoke in support of the bill, talked about all of his meetings with local administrators and how it's very, very common that they bring it up as something they supported, that the legislature allowed in 2020. And that flexibility is really helpful for them as they're planning the last couple of weeks leading up to the election and all the things that have to happen in that tight timeline. The absentee drop box language included, it does keep it as permissive as to whether or not local jurisdictions have these 24/7 drop boxes for absentee ballots. But the provisions included expand voter access, it updates signage, as well as codifies a log process for ballot collection. And then finally, we provided provided in there is that the Secretary's office will collect data from local jurisdictions as to how voters are returning those absentee ballots, which will hopefully be valuable information to all of you. The last bill that I wanted to, or portion of this bill that I wanted to touch on is the protections for election administrators. So protecting our election judges and officials through the language included here is one way to demonstrate support for those administering our free and fair elections and all the work that they do. When this bill was heard, testifiers and David Maeda, my colleague, outlined the increasing tension as well as threats that election workers deal with in Minnesota. Thank you for taking this action so that we have some tools to punish any perpetrators should more egregious acts happen relating to harassment or coercion or doxing of those election administrators and election judges. We know that we've seen it across the country, and so this proactive action is really helpful. Thank you again for hearing my testimony today, and for that, I'll stand with questions. I will stand for questions. Thank you.
Hang around. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Hang around, and we get to the end of the testifiers. We'll take questions. The next person I have on my list is Deputy Commissioner Britta Rattan. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Britta Rattan. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota Management and Budget, and I want to thank you for allowing me time today to provide our feedback on House File 4293. At MMB, as you know, we're stewards of the state's financial and human resources, delivering effective services for the people of Minnesota. And our agency is responsible for managing state finances, payroll, human resources, and employee insurance. We also provide the IT systems for the state's daily business operations and information access and analysis. MMB is a central service agency with about 260 employees who serve the governor, the legislature, more than 100 state government agencies, a workforce of 56,000 employees, and the public. I want to thank you and the committee for the work you've done so far during session to put together a comprehensive package to help modernize, streamline, and improve state government services. In particular, I would like to point out some specific proposals that are included in this bill that were in the governor's supplemental budget recommendations. First, I'm happy to see that the bill adopts the governor's recommendation to address the critical funding shortfall for the IT systems that MMB manages and supports that make up our state's enterprise resource planning or ERP technology systems. Employees in all three branches of state government use these IT systems for their day-to-day operations, including accounting, procurement, data reporting, payroll, human resource management, recruiting, and employee benefits. It costs MMB $22 million a year, approximately, to maintain, operate, and enhance the state's ERP systems. And these critical systems do not have a sustainable funding solution currently. Under statute, we are capped at $10 million annually for how much we can bill other agencies in the statewide systems account. The funding that's provided in this bill addresses this key shortfall and is responsive as well to an Office of the Legislative Auditor report from 2018. MMB and the legislature have a shared responsibility to find a sustainable funding solution. Your inclusion of this recommendation will allow MMB to stabilize, secure, and sustain these at-risk systems. And the funding also provides a path forward as we develop a new ERP IT solution into the future. Beyond this key proposal to stabilize and sustain our ERP systems, the governor put forward other recommendations to advance and enhance MMB's ability to serve Minnesotans, and I want to thank you for those as well. A couple of those proposals include the proposal to evaluate the impact of state investments. This proposal will provide the personnel necessary to continue to conduct rigorous evaluations of new or innovative projects and help determine whether state investments are effective in achieving the desired outcomes, as well as the cross-agency coordination of the Children's Cabinet. This proposal provides coordination across agencies on issues impacting children, including education strategies from birth onward, parenting strategies, mental health, services for older youth, and community family supports, as well as childcare. I would also like to highlight that MMB is carrying a key budget item on behalf of the enterprise for the state's emergency COVID-19 response that's not reflected in this bill. The governor's recommendation establishes additional flexible funding for ongoing responses to the pandemic. And we all know that COVID-19 has been unpredictable, and we've demonstrated the importance of having flexible state resources available. The COVID-19 flexible account has previously been used to address emerging issues and quickly provide funding for critical needs, such as emergency nursing facilities grants, emergency staff hospital decompression, emergency training, and rapid at-home testing. Continued flexible funding will be necessary for the state to respond to the evolving COVID-19 pandemic. I look forward, and we look forward at MMB, to working with the House to ensure this critical need is met, even if it's not within this state government target. I also just want to flag that I appreciate the inclusion of some key policy items in House File 4293. These include the military pay differential technical language that we brought forward previously. This proposal clarifies our payment procedures for employees in reserve forces who have to report to active service. These service members are paid the difference between their state pay and active service pay. And this bill also makes sure that service members that were previously overpaid in error do not need to repay those funds to the state. There's also a policy proposal related to collateral modernization. This proposal allows banks to use lines of credit, which function like insurance, as collateral when they're competing for the state's banking business. Banks already have this option when serving local governments, and it is a cheaper and a more straightforward approach for them, so it'll make us more competitive as we put out our banking contracts. And then the last policy item that I just want to thank you for including is the Housing Trust Fund transfers. This proposal is streamlining our services by moving the revenue collection responsibilities for the Housing Trust Fund account and the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund account from MMB to Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And they are, in fact, the agency where the programs are funded and where the accounts are managed. We look forward to working with you in the coming weeks as this bill moves forward. MMB staff are all available to assist you, committee members, to achieve our shared objectives, serving the people of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity again to testify, and I can take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Tan. The next person I have on the list is Judy Barrel. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Julie Byrol. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Administration, and I'm pinch-hitting for Commissioner Robert Stavis, who had to run over to the Senate today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We want to commend the work done by you and the committee on House File 4293 to fund essential operations of state government. Minnesota's historic budget surplus affords us the unique opportunity to invest in our communities and ensure that key support services are available to serve Minnesotans. By funding the majority of Governor Walz's budget recommendations for the Department of Administration, you are funding previous legislative commitments as well as adequately supporting services that Minnesotans expect. The bill makes strategic investments to ensure that state dollars have the most impact by leveraging federal dollars for the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, which assists businesses to build the capacity to effectively compete for and earn local, state, and federal contracts. It also improves administration oversight of public grant awards and management with funding for the Office of Grants Management. Funding in House File 4293 will enhance admin's operations in the areas of human resources, accounting services, and dispute resolution. The bill will also stabilize the fleet fund, streamline work in the data practices office, and cover the costs related to COVID-19 workers' compensation claims under Chapter 32. Investments in a new Office of Enterprise Translations will provide critical information translated for Minnesotans in a timely manner. Finally, admin appreciates the inclusion of important policy changes. Updating the Private Cemeteries Act will reflect federal law, begin to modernize outdated terminology, clarify authority over cemetery assessments, and recognize the sovereignty of tribal nations that share our borders. The bill also provides the necessary capacity for the Office of State Archaeologists to coordinate this work. Additionally, the bill includes admin's language to provide flexibility for state agencies and local governments to meet the Sustainable Building 2030 requirements. And these good governance updates will help to improve the sustainability and cost effectiveness of state operations. I also want to thank you for including our policy and technical changes, which will help to remove some obsolete language and streamline our work. Again, thank you for your consideration and inclusion of the governor's budget recommendations, and admin looks forward to working with you through the committee process. I'll stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The next person I have on my list is Brandon Hirsch from Minute. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Brandon Hirsch, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Minnesota IT Services. Chair Nelson and members of the committee, on behalf of Commissioner Tomes and Minnett, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today and strong support of the technology investment proposals that are included in House File 4293. When taken together, the investments that were proposed by the governor and included in House File 4293 include advanced cybersecurity tools, application modernization, digital accessibility, and accelerated cloud adoption that are fundamental for the state's ability to adapt to an increasingly mobile and digital-first society, as well as in helping the state prepare for, respond to, and mitigate the impact of cyber attacks. Technology modernization and cybersecurity protections are really two sides of the same coin. Minnett is grateful that the committee recognizes the critical role that digital services play in connecting Minnesotans to the state and how these investments would ensure the delivery of secure, modern, and scalable services to Minnesotans. We look forward to working with you, Chair Nelson, and members of the committee to ensure that the importance of these investments continues to be recognized through the remainder of the legislative session. I'm happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. The next person I have on my list is Mr. Wentworth from the Historical Society. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Kent Wentworth. I serve as the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Chair Nelson, members of the House State Government Finance Committee, I would simply and briefly like to say thank you. The Minnesota Historical Society sincerely appreciates your support in this bill. Funding for the operating support initiative will assist us with cost of running our statewide operations, including the cost of salaries and benefits for our talented and dedicated staff. Funding for reopening will assist with staffing and other costs for our public-facing services as we all recover from the pandemic and economic challenges. We also appreciate the inclusion of the policy language to finish the historic preservation cleanup language in Chapter 138. Mr. Chair and committee members, we are ready to assist in any way as this bill moves forward through the process. Again, thank you so much for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth. The next person I have on my list is Kathleen Kelso. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathleen Kelso, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Board on Aging. We want to thank you, Chair Nelson, and the committee members, and most especially Representative Claiborne, for supporting what was House File 4036 and is now Article 2, Section 74 of House File 4293. We want to point out that, again, the pandemic and the subsequent long-term care workforce crisis has alerted all of us to the impact and opportunities an aging population does have on our state. A legislative task force will address the necessity for a statewide plan of action across all state agencies and hopefully lead to efficient partnerships and investments with businesses and nonprofits, local government, and neighborhoods to ensure healthy aging in the future. If you have any questions of the Board on Aging, please do not hesitate to contact us. The letter of thanks is on in the handout, list of handouts that you have before you. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you, Ms. Kelso. And the only question I would have would be, how can I stop getting older? But anyway. Yeah.
Maybe anyway. The task force can figure that out. Thank you.
The last person I have on my list is Matt Hilger from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. Thank you to you, Mr. Chair, and members for putting together this bill. I know how much hard work goes to this, as well as staff and House counsel. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Albright for his bill providing local governments with additional investment flexibility in their insurance trusts. We're appreciative for the inclusion of that. Also, I see Representative Elkins is on today. We want to thank him specifically for his cybersecurity grants for local and tribal governments. This is really important for us, and we appreciate that investment. I'd like to put in a plug for the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Funding Request. OCDR is their acronym, and they have been instrumental in forwarding the state-local agreement on the opioid settlement. Because of their work to basically collaborate with various levels of local government, all the counties, several hundred cities, and the state, our state and local governments will be receiving tremendous resources in the future to battle the effects of this pandemic. That alone, they've paid for their services well over for the state. But they also have been helping us in recent years help bridge divides. I think one of the most effective things about local county governance is that we are nonpartisan. Most counties are nonpartisan. They have to roll up their sleeves and get things done. That said, we live in a pretty hyper-politicized world right now, and OCDR has been instrumental, especially in teaching our new commissioners as they educate themselves on what is county governance, how to be transparent, how to be effective, and how to be professional. So I just want to thank that office for all their work, and I think it's like one. I'm still astounded that Ms. Mariah Levinson can do all this by herself, it seems. So we definitely support that request. Regarding the elections article, I first want to thank Representative Greenman. She's been reaching out to AMC and election officials throughout the year on all these provisions. We're very pleased to see Article 3, Section 41 back in the House state government bill. But this is the provision that the House has always supported in a bipartisan fashion, and that is to allow mail balloting for all towns and cities under that 400 registered voters number. We are really hopeful that we can eventually move this across the line. We shouldn't be treating voters differently dependent on where they live geographically in the state. Election officials are grateful for the expansion of absentee balloting processing, the uniformity of expectations on drop box ballot logs, as well as the language protecting staff from intimidation and interference. And lastly, I want to just put in a plug again for the transparency on non-governmental mailings. I think this is an important piece. Voters get a lot of information in the mail, and to the extent that we can be transparent on who that's being sent by, and the fact that these are not real ballots, that is really important as an education piece and transparency piece. So we were really delighted to see that in there. Thanks again, members, for all your work, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. And that's, members, that's the bill that we have. Any questions? And while I'm waiting for hands to come up, like I said, we're going to amendments to the DE2 amendment are due by 3 o'clock this afternoon. We'll start taking amendments and working through those tomorrow and hopefully get this bill passed out tomorrow, between tomorrow and Friday. Questions, members? I don't see any questions. Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard earlier in the presentation when Ms. Roberts was going through, we've got a chief diversity and inclusion officer for the legislature. Where did that come from, Mr. Chair?
I believe that was a bill. I'm trying to remember which exactly bill that came out of. Maybe Ms. Roberts or Mr. Gehring could give me a hand there.
Mr. Chair, that was one of the LCC's requests. I don't know if Ms. Weber is still on the call. She might be able to provide some insight on that. There's a drafted bill for that. It's just the part of the LCC request.
That was part of the LCC request. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Ms. Weber, are you still on the call?
Mr. Chair and members, I am. For the record, I'm Michelle Weber, the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Representative Joskowski, thank you for the question. That provision was something that was included in the LCC budget during the 2021 legislative session and was carried by the House.
Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Ms. Weber. What will this person do? The word officer connotes that this person is going to have a badge on. Is this going to be, you know, the liberal, woke, multicultural compliance officer, or what are they going to do?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joskowski, this would be a human resources type position. The position description was worked on in collaboration with the human resources directors of the House and the Senate, and it would provide training and be a technical assistance liaison to both bodies of the legislature, as well as the joint offices and commissions.
Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Ms. Weber. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I struggle with the agenda that continues to present itself throughout these bills. The social engineering that we have going on throughout many of these bills, now it's going to be presented in the legislature. I really struggle with that. But we'll have more discussion as we go forward with each of these threads that continue to be brought before us by the far left ideas that are coming forward this session. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Weber.
Thank you, Representative Joskowski. Any further questions? Any further questions? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see that Ms. Freeman is on from the Secretary of State's office and is trying to email her question. Previously in committee, when the Secretary was testifying, they were going to get us information about how many same-day voter the vouching system was used during election years, and I still haven't received that information. As maybe you can follow up with me offline and provide that.
Ms. Freeman?
We have it now.
Ms. Freeman?
I will do that, Representative Kosnick. Thank you.
If you could share that with the rest of the committee also, that'd be great.
Absolutely, yep.
Any further questions? I'll say it one more time. Any further questions? Thank you, members, and I look forward to a robust discussion tomorrow and Friday. And with that, members, if there are no more questions or comments, this meeting will be adjourned.